This is Law and Disorder.
Today on Law and Disorder, as part of our Lawyers You'll Like series, we speak with attorney Linda Baquiel from Puerto Rico.
If you're interested in courage, and the courage of a lawyer who's willing to defend independentistas in Puerto Rico, you'll like this lawyer, Linda Baquiel.
We talk with attorney Myron Beldock, who represented the late Reuben Hurricane Carter.
Wrongfully convicted again and again by a system of criminal justice that remains racist at its core.
Stay with us.
I'm New York City attorney and author Michael Smith.
I'm Heidi Bogosian, executive director of the A.J. Musty Memorial Institute.
And I'm Michael Ratner, president emeritus of the Center for Constitutional Rights. As part of our Lawyers You'll Like series, today we talk with Linda Baquiel. She's a lawyer and poet living in San Juan, Puerto Rico. She's played an instrumental role in defending independentistas and the fight against colonialism in Puerto Rico. As part of that struggle, she defended those who ultimately were successful in kicking the military out of Vieques, an island off Puerto Rico. For her 40 years of law practice, she has devoted much of her energy to the defense of political prisoners, often with her friend and mentor, Lenny Wineglass. Linda, welcome to Law and Disorder.
Attorney Linda Baquiel, welcome to Law and Disorder.
Thank you. I'm delighted to be here.
Well, last time I saw you, it was actually in San Juan, Puerto Rico. And you've got a law practice there. Are you engaged actively in criminal defense work still?
Very.
What's a typical day for you now as an active criminal defense lawyer in San Juan?
Well, Puerto Rico has a disproportionate number of cases certified for the death penalty. And I'm currently doing two appeals that were tried as death penalty cases. To date, no Puerto Rican jury has returned a death verdict, although I've lost count of the number, but a very large number of cases have been certified. Puerto Rico's constitution makes the death penalty unconstitutional. I would say 65% of the population at least is Roman Catholic. The religion does not approve of the death penalty, but the cases are tried and very contentious. So I have two appeals from those cases right now. I have one case that was indicted as a death penalty case, but never certified, thank God. And I have just finished a couple of what we call mega cases, which are cases in which literally a whole community, say 125 people in this case, are indicted for selling drugs, which frankly is the only economic activity that goes on there.
Yeah, well, we've been reading about the terrible economic straits of the colony of Puerto Rico.
Yeah, we do want to get to that. Before we get there with you, Linda, you became, I mean, we all know of you and we've worked with you on different cases, but if I associate anything in my mind with you, it's the struggle against U.S. colonialism in Puerto Rico. It's as a representative of a lawyer for many of the people in the independence movement, and we've actually had an interview with you before on Filiberto's case. So can you take us into that work a bit, a little bit about Filiberto and what other kind of work you've worked on in the independence movement?
Well, we're approaching the 10th anniversary of the assassination of Filiberto Herrera Ríos by the FBI on September 23rd of 2005. He was, at the time of his murder, the leading figure in the struggle against independence. He was, at the time, underground, having successfully fought off a trial here in San Juan for attempted murder of an FBI agent. The Puerto Rico jury acquitted him on the defense that he was defending a Puerto Rican home, his own. I don't know. There's so much history to it. But Puerto Rico, for many years, I would say from the time of the invasion in 1898, has had a very active struggle against colonialism. It has taken every form. Probably the most novel and recent form is any kind of civil disobedience. I remember Filiberto saying to me many years ago that it was simply not part of Puerto Rico's tradition because the repression had been so violent. It proved successful in kicking the U.S. Navy out of Vieques, which is a case I spent a number of years defending people in relation to.
Those were people who went on to the military base on Vieques. Give us a tiny bit of history, because I know each of these cases could take a whole program.
It was two-thirds of the island that the U.S. Navy had reserved for bombing practice, storing munitions, and just in case it wanted to use it for something. So that was two-thirds of a municipality that since late 1940s had been essentially reserved for military use with people squeezed in between two humongous military areas. And in 1999, the Navy accidentally dropped a bomb on one of its security guards, who was supposed to be in the observation post watching to see that nobody, no civilians, were in the danger area. And that kicked off a struggle that lasted until May of 2003 or 5, I believe it was 2003, to effectively evict the Navy from Vieques. The people of Vieques, with the support of all of Puerto Rico, were successful, and they were successful mainly because hundreds, no, close to 1,000 people were arrested, and many were jailed for up to 6 months for daring to walk onto soil of Vieques that the Navy had claimed for itself.
Can you put that into the context of some of the Puerto Rican struggles that you've been involved with? That's just one of the cases. There were cases, as you said, it's been a strong independence movement for a very long time.
Well, the case of Filiberto Ojeda Rios was a case, there were a number of cases, but for many years I worked on the defense of a case in Hartford against members of Los Macheteros, who held up a Wells Fargo truck in Hartford, Connecticut, and walked away with over $7 million. It was never recovered. They issued statements saying it was to finance the independence movement. Some of the money was used to hand out toys on Three Kings Day. Eventually, 15 people were arrested and accused of conspiracy. Filiberto was the head of that movement and was ultimately not tried, but assassinated by the FBI in relation to that. As Michael Ratner knows well, there were many grand juries investigating the Puerto Rican independence movement, starting in the 60s and 70s up until the most recent one died a sort of quiet death, and it's hard to tell when, but it was within the last 10 years, probably within the last 5 years. Just because people from Puerto Rico traveled a lot to Cuba, to Venezuela, to anywhere where international support for independence and the anti-colonial movement was strong. So there were many, many investigations. There were investigations of the Puerto Rican Socialist Party, Puerto Rican Independence Party, labor organizations in Puerto Rico, which have been very, very strong and very combative, and many of which tended to favor independence, the teachers' union. Really, it's crossed all phases of life in Puerto Rico.
Linda, tell us, if you will, about the months you spent in jail for civil contempt.
That was actually a grand jury case against you.
Right. It was.
But relate that to the struggle.
Right.
Right. Well, I can't unrelate it to the struggle. I worked for many years as a staff attorney for the Grand Jury Project with the help of the sponsorship, co-sponsorship of the Center for Constitutional Rights, the National Lawyers Guild, and the New York Women's Union initially. And we fought grand jury abuse mainly through education, a publication called Quash. We advised lawyers around the country who were combating what was then a wave of political grand juries. It was after that that I became involved in the Hartford trial and the representation of Filiberto Ojeda, as well as other people charged in that case. After we did the unthinkable and won bail for him after he was detained without trial for 33 months, and after we beat charges of attempting to assassinate the FBI here in San Juan, He was out on bail. I had relocated here to Puerto Rico, and one day I was in the office where I was working and living, and he looked out the door and said, there are some people downstairs calling your name. And I went downstairs, and there was the case agent from the case in Hartford and the case agent from the case here in Puerto Rico against him. And they said, Linda, we have something for you. And they handed me a subpoena to a grand jury in Philadelphia. And what the grand jury in Philadelphia wanted to ask me about was a client of mine whom I had represented during a trial in Philadelphia against her and Dr. Ellen Berkman for political activities and an arrest in the Philadelphia area. It had absolutely nothing to do with the independence movement. But that case had been dormant for over 5 years. So I simply said, I can't testify about a client behind closed doors ever. Doesn't matter what the circumstances are. I just can't do that. It's unethical, and it's contrary to everything I have stood for. So the end of the line, we fought for a really long time. It was a lot of fun. And at the end of the line, the judge says, well, I'm going to find you in civil contempt. So I spent 6 months in the Bucks County Jail in Pennsylvania, which was a fascinating, marvelous experience. I really, really think that every single person who pretends to be a lawyer, and especially prosecutors and judges or criminal defense lawyers, should spend a minimum of 3 days in jail, a weekend and one weekday, just to understand what that phenomenon is. And get some sense of who's in jail, which is a very wide cross-section of people, but clearly more third-world people than wealthy white people. It's just a marvelous experience. It was humanly incredibly rich. It was physically difficult and trying, but I'm really thankful, not to the prosecutor, but I'm thankful to the universe for that experience.
Well, you wrote that it was uncomfortable, but that it was a real challenge and kind of a character builder. Tell us about some of the situations that happened to you while you were in there. Like, how did you relate to the other inmates when they learned that you were an attorney?
It was a very human experience, and I helped a lot of inmates, and the guards would regulate the number of visits to my cell, because inmates had to get cell to had to get permission to visit somebody else's cell. So they would go to the guard. And the guards, when they thought I was very tired, would limit the number of inmates that could come to consult me at night. When I learned that I was going to be released, which came as a great surprise to me, I asked for special permission to address everybody at once. Well, normally when one prisoner talks to everybody at once, it's called a riot. I was given that permission in order to be able to thank everyone and say goodbye and say how privileged I was to have been able to share in their lives and serve them. What was hard for me was that I was a vegetarian and nobody understood what that was about, so I kept having terrible migraines and falling down, and they mainly wanted to just take my blood to make sure I wasn't dying of some terrible disease, and that was kind of a nightmare, but I learned to run. I got more exercise than I ever did on the street. I went outside every day, and the guards would come to me and say, oh, you don't want to go outside today. It's 12 below. I did want to go outside, but mainly I wanted to go outside because I got to run around, and they had to stand there and freeze.
Linda, you know, one thing on that experience, weren't you ever worried about losing your law license? I mean, yeah. They can take licenses away for that kind of thing, or at least
I studied the situation pretty carefully, and civil contempt on a professional, you know, for a principled, debatable legal reason, although you lose, is really a grounds for taking your license away. That didn't stop the prosecutor who had me jailed from trying to take my license away, but I fought that and beat it.
Well, you said, I can't give evidence against a client of mine or I'll lose the trust of every future client.
Exactly.
It seems to me to be a pretty powerful argument.
Well, here I am. It worked.
Linda, I want to go back to something you opened this segment with, which is to talk about colonialism and the economy. And, of course, we've all read about how Puerto Rico, or the governor said, we can't pay the $73 billion in bonds. Puerto Rico can't go into bankruptcy. So talk about your politics around that comment you made about colonialism and the economy, and then perhaps something about the current situation.
Well, I think that colonialism has strangled Puerto Rico's economy since the very first day. There's a metaphor for that, a physical metaphor for that, which is San Juan's streets are paved with these lovely blue stones, and everybody says, the people who come from abroad say, oh, look at this. Isn't that interesting? The streets are blue. Well, those blue stones were ballast to keep the ships that came over from Spain from blowing over in the wind because they didn't bring anything of value. The stones were left in San Juan because they went home laden with riches. And that's the nature of colonialism. It's always been to squeeze the orange as dry as possible and then throw away what's left. And that's essentially what has happened in Puerto Rico for 500 years. So is it any wonder that Puerto Rico has borrowed too much? Debt grows faster than the economy right now. Many things are broken, dysfunctional. And, you know, the people on Wall Street are saying, well, that's tough, but you can do it. Just pay up. And, you know, if you're really lucky, maybe it will let you take a little longer, but of course the interest rates will be higher. So that's, in a nutshell, what Puerto Rico is facing right now. You said Puerto Rico can't declare bankruptcy. Well, no state can declare bankruptcy either, but most states have the option of allowing their public corporations or municipalities or both to go bankrupt. Puerto Rico does not have that. It does not have that, not because Puerto Rico didn't enact a law saying it could do that. It doesn't have it because in 1984, when the federal bankruptcy law was amended, Congress decided that Puerto Rico would not be treated as a state which had powers under the federal bankruptcy law to allow its municipalities and public utilities or publicly owned corporations to declare bankruptcy. So the naive Puerto Rican legislators thought, well, that's federal law. We'll make our own. But colonialism says your own laws are only okay as long as we say they are, and there are bondholders in the U.S. who are unhappy about this. No go.
Linda, you referred to a couple of drug-related cases, and I'm curious about the incarceration numbers. How many people are incarcerated in Puerto Rico, and what are the main crimes?
Boy, you know, that's a good question, and I don't have numbers. Let me tell you that the numbers of people incarcerated in Puerto Rico don't reflect the number of people from Puerto Rico who were sentenced. The trick here is that most significant drug trafficking is prosecuted by the federal government, not the local government. But the federal government has no institution for sentenced prisoners in Puerto Rico. Right now, there are about 1,000 pretrial detainees in Puerto Rico in federal prison designed for about 750. I think it's 738. But that's a drop in the bucket. Those are the people who are awaiting trial. The District of Puerto Rico has more cases than any district other than border districts, which have mainly fast-track immigration cases. We don't have very many fast-track immigration cases at all. The bulk of our cases are drug cases. And the bulk of our drug cases are cases involving 20 defendants and more, up to 125. So, you know, raw numbers I can't give you, but it's a huge number of people who have at one time in their lives been prosecuted for selling drugs. And essentially, these mega cases are not some really large, tight organization. You think of, you know, I don't know, the Salvatruchas or something like that. No, no, no. What we have are communities where there is no employment, education levels are not great, and the way for kids to get money is to sell drugs. And they get recruited at 12 or 13, and they learn how to do it, and the ones who are good then get to have their own supplier and sellers and lookouts, and you have a whole bunch of little drug enterprises, one right next to another, which sometimes cooperate on security. So that is very common in many, many of the poorer barrios, communities, and public housing projects.
Linda, I know you've been active, as I said earlier, in the Puerto Rican independence movement for a long, long time. It became, at least for us, a very important movement, particularly in the 70s, even in the United States. We had 1 million Puerto Ricans living in New York. The political parties were very active here, Puerto Rican Socialist Party and others. A lot of us got politicized, in part, through the struggle for Puerto Rico. And in some way, if I look with my little bit of knowledge, it seemed to be a height of the independence struggle at that point, of all different sorts, the left, the middle, etc. But what's the sense now of people thinking about or actively thinking about independence?
Well, you know, people is a very broad word. I think that on the plus side, the fear of the flag and nationalist to autonomous sentiment has been greatly reduced. After Filiberto's murder, violent repression was, FBI got a little bit burned by that, and the repression has not been violent. And culturally and civically and across the board, nobody's afraid to fly the Puerto Rican flag anymore, and it's socially acceptable in almost every situation for almost anyone to express deep pride at Puerto Rico as a nation. On the negative side, you know, there are three major parties, political electoral parties in Puerto Rico. One favors statehood, one favors the middle of the road, whatever that is at the moment, and the other favors independence. All three parties have had the same leaders for 40 years, and each one is becoming more and more irrelevant in its own way. That's the simple truth. There are a number of parties that have sprung up, Workers' Party, People's Party, the Movement for Sovereignty, that are all more or less pro-autonomous or pro-independence. They make very poor showing electorally, which the Independence Party also always has. But I think they're evidence of a new eagerness to unite those who want to affirm Puerto Rico's right to exist as an independent nation. It's a terribly uphill struggle. But I think there's more openness to the idea, and I think there are more grassroots and community-based and proto-party groupings that will make that possible in the future.
Linda, we just have a few minutes remaining, but we'd like to ask you to share a bit about your early years and why you chose to become a lawyer.
Actually, you know, I don't know if you've seen the movie 1971, but yes. I was very close to that activity and those people. And even before that, a bunch of friends of mine, 21, got arrested for a draft board action in Camden, New Jersey. And I participated as a legal worker in their trial, which was astonishing for being able to present a necessity defense in response to the need to stop the war and stop the draft.
You should remind people what 1971 is.
1971 is the movie, a documentary movie about the burglary of the FBI offices in Media, Pennsylvania that revealed the existence of the COINTELPRO program. So that was all taking place in Philadelphia, where there was a strong Quaker action movement, a Catholic left, Jewish left, whatever, mainly pacifist, taking very bold actions, more than symbolic civil disobedience. My friends were busted. I worked on the Camden trial, and there were wonderful political lawyers involved, including David Karas and David Rudofsky. Yeah. And many defendants were pro se. And I said, you know, I really want to be able to articulate the struggles in a courtroom. I want to be able to speak the truth to power in that way. And I'd always been interested in law, but I wandered off and studied medieval literature. And I'm still interested in medieval literature and poetry and other things. But at that point in history, that's where my attention went. And I was also very involved in the feminist movement and went to law school teaching at night, working women's history, and started my career with Karyson Rudofsky, a criminal defense and civil rights firm, a lot of police abuse practice. That was the beginning. After that, eventually made my way to New York. I worked at the Grand Jury Project. I hung out at the Center for Constitutional Rights and did little projects there. Then, to make a very long story much shorter, became involved with the defense of Puerto Rican independence stuff.
Oh, what an inspiration you are.
Really wonderful. I only have one little story about the Camden 28. My former partner, who you know, Margaret Ratner Kunstler, was working as a public legal aid type lawyer in 116th Street in New York. And one day she's in her office and her legal assistant is there working with her. And the FBI comes in, handcuffs her legal assistant, and he turns out to be one of the Camden 28.
Oh, wow. That's a great story.
Anyway, it was, when she came home, she couldn't believe it.
Anyway, it was like, 21, Camden.
Oh, 21, Camden 21.
21, right.
A great bunch.
Yeah, and we should also mention that the movie 1971 was based in part in the works around the same time as Betty Metzger's book, The Burglary.
Absolutely. Yeah. It was based on the book.
Yeah.
And Betty was a friend of some of the prime movers in that and kept the secret for many, many years.
Right.
And recently published the book.
And, you know, we didn't bring out that Linda is a very fine poet, actually, not just a medieval poet. It's actually... but she wrote a beautiful poem, which is... Was it you who read it on here, or did we read it on our show?
About Lenny. Weinglass.
About Lenny Weinglass, who I know you're very close to. But it's one that we'll link again to this interview because it's, along with the interview that we did with you on Filiberto, a really moving poem about Lenny Weinglass.
Well, thank you.
It's been such a pleasure to chat with you, and we hope to have you on again to talk more about you and your political and legal background.
Well, it's been a pleasure to touch base with all of you again, and I'm glad you're still there doing what you do.
Thank you, Linda.
Thanks, Linda.
Visit us online at lawanddisorder.org for archived programs and links to many of the issues we discuss. Thank you.
Celebrated boxer and prisoner rights activist Reuben Hurricane Carter died of cancer at age 76. He'd become an international symbol of racial injustice after his two wrongful murder convictions forced him to spend 19 years in prison in New Jersey. Carter was arrested for a triple murder in his hometown of Paterson. He was convicted by an all-white jury, white judge, white prosecutor, and sentenced to three consecutive life sentences. In 1976, the New Jersey State Supreme Court overturned his conviction on the grounds that the authorities withheld material evidence from the defense. But Carter was convicted again in a second trial in 76, and in 1985, that conviction was overturned by a U.S. District Court judge who concluded that the state made an unconstitutional appeal to racial prejudice. In 1988, the Passaic, New Jersey Prosecutor's Office dropped all charges against Carter. We talked today with his attorney, Myron Belduck, who served as his counsel almost from the beginning and was the one responsible for getting Reuben Hurricane Carter out of prison.
Myron, welcome to Law and Disorder.
Thank you.
Now, we're very familiar with the case, but for our listeners who are not aware, can you briefly describe Reuben Hurricane Carter's lawsuits and prison cases?
Well, there were no civil lawsuits. He was a defendant in a criminal case in New Jersey. It involved the triple shooting and ultimately three murders of three people in the Lafayette Bar in Paterson, New Jersey, going back to 1966. And he and his co-defendant, John Artis, were represented at the first trial, and they lost. That is, they were convicted. And then Reuben started his campaign to get out of jail and wrote his book, The 16th Round. And ultimately, in 1974, when the eyewitnesses, supposed eyewitnesses, who were not, we claim, recanted, Selwyn Rabb, who was an investigative reporter at the Times, who had worked with me before that on the Whitmore case, Selwyn asked me whether I was interested in representing Reuben. And I had just finished 7 years working on this other case and really didn't want to get involved in another long battle. But I went to see Reuben, and he was charismatic and powerful and a great thinker. He was a very, very, very intellectually strong person as well as being spiritually strong. And so I was drawn into his ambit, and then we went off. The killings were shotgun and pistol shootings of these three people. The original witnesses were two, I would say, criminal types who were involved in breaking into a factory a block away at the time of the shootings in 1966. And then the first conviction was set aside because it turned out that the prosecution had been trading benefits to those two particular people for their stories, which their original information and all original information described people completely different than Reuben and John. John was a tall young man. Reuben was a very black, very solidly built, bald-headed person. And you wouldn't begin to suspect them from the information about the descriptions of the people who did the killings. One of the people who ultimately died, in fact, two of them saw Reuben and John in the hospital that night, and they did not identify them, and so on. It was almost a typical case, high-profile case, where you get people who are vulnerable and easily manipulated because of their need for their own benefits to falsely testify. Then we set aside the conviction because of learning about the benefits that were given to the witnesses, and went again to trial in 1975. At that time, the atmosphere had changed. There was a new prosecutor. They came up with the theory that this was actually a racial revenge killing. Earlier that night, a white former bar owner had shot and killed the black purchaser of the bar from him. And that was always known. and there was no motive attributed to the killings in the first trial. But in the second trial, really based upon nothing but speculation and bias, they argued persuasively to the jury that this was really a racial revenge killing, that the black people went into the white bar, the Lafayette bar, to revenge the killing of the black person by the white former bar owner. And that was one of the ultimate reasons why, many, many years later, the convictions were set aside. But the other reason was the one I was most prominently involved in. At the second trial, Mr. Bellow, who was the only supposed eyewitness who testified, there were two of them at the first trial, was being questioned by me on the stand as to why he recanted his recantation. The prosecution had persuaded him to again tell the story he told at the first trial, identifying Reuben and John. And I was trying to establish that they had falsely manipulated him when I was pulled into the chambers along with my co-counsel, Lewis Steele, who represented John Otis, and told that if I questioned him further, the jury would learn that he had passed the lie detector test supporting what he had said at the first trial, supporting his identification. And we did have that test, and it seemed like that was the result, because that's the way it was written. In fact, that was a fraud. It was, just like the first trial, it was a total cheat. The polygraph results were completely the opposite of what they were purported to be. Just before the sentencing in the second trial, 1976, I called the polygrapher, who we thought was an enemy, and he was in a sense, but I had an intro to him from a well-known New York City investigator. And I said, "Hey, John," said, "I could call you and speak to you and give you my name, and that you can rely on me." And then all of a sudden he tells me that the results of the test were opposite to what they were purported to be. You think we could win? Well, we didn't win then. We didn't win for, how many years? That was 1976. It was 1985 when we finally got a federal judge to recognize these two basic flaws in the prosecution. That was Judge Sarakin, who went over all the years of all the evidence and came to that conclusion that we were essentially cheated. I use the word cheated because that's what it was. And the prosecutors in that case, two of them became judges, rewarded for what they did.
Well, let me ask you, so the two key elements were being cheated was, one was the false lie detector results, right. And the other one, say it again, was?
That John and Reuben killed the white people at the Lafayette Bar to retaliate from the earlier shooting of a black bartender that night by the white former bar owner. There's no evidence that John or Reuben were involved in being biased against white people, just the opposite. They both had lots of relationships with white people. There was just no evidentiary basis for this argument.
The racial revenge theory.
Racial revenge theory was made up based upon the fact that it had to be because a white person killed a black person, so black people killed white persons. I mean, it was the most flimsy, but in many ways very persuasive. Remember, this is a community that was shocked by the killings. There were three of their own who were killed, one who survived. Reuben was not a popular person. He had been an outspoken civil rights person. There were, false rumors about his being a person who would support killing people, killing white people. I mean, it was a cesspool of rumors without any evidentiary basis that led to the prosecution. And I can tell you, as one who was there, that the entire community almost in Passaic, New Jersey, treated us like we were the devil. We were enemies. I mean, it was the coldest community reception I ever encountered any place.
Myron, Michael Smith here. I was part of his defense early on and went down and met him in prison in Trenton and then again at that minimum security prison that he got into. What confused me about why people would think there was a man who was on the top of his game. He was contender for the middleweight title. He had a wife, he had a daughter.
It just didn't make any sense that he would go to a bar that he'd never been to before and kill people he never knew. It was just, you know, utter racist fantasy that they could do that to him.
Well, I of course agree with you. And when you speak of Rubin's public face and notoriety, I didn't know he was charged originally, but I read about the conviction in a newspaper and heard about it on TV when that happened. That was in 1967, I think. And I just thought this makes, I was a sports fan, and I thought this makes no sense. How could a person like that? Why would a person like that? How could he possibly do that? He was prominently known, his face was known, and so on and so on. So that's one of the reasons why, same reaction you have, that I got interested in working for Rubin in the first place.
The other thing that was so striking, and Rubin told me, the degree of corruption in the state of New Jersey. I suppose that you could say it hasn't changed much with Chris Christie. But back then, Rubin said that the prosecutor in nearby Patterson County, of course, Rubin was in Passaic County, but the prosecutor in Patterson County was an attorney named Byrne, who later became governor. Rubin said that it was Byrne that arranged to give the lighter sentence to Bellow and Bradley in exchange for their testimony. So Rubin said this thing is corrupt from top to bottom.
Well, I think it was corrupt, but I don't know about the Byrne angle. They certainly gave benefits to both Bellow and Bradley, who had been the original witnesses, by not prosecuting them or not putting them in jail for their various crimes. They were very unreliable witnesses. Bellow was an exceedingly dishonest person. And the whole story about the lie detector test is absurd because he was kind of the immoral kind of person who didn't care about the truth. That was established over the years in many investigations and many aspects of the case.
Let's talk about Rubin and the work that he did, because it seems to me, without being melodramatic, he was truly a tragic and heroic figure. And after, with your great legal skills, got him out of prison, he then moved up to Canada and did work supporting innocent people.
Yes.
And I wanted to ask you about that.
I followed Rubin's career afterwards. We would talk occasionally, but Rubin would call every year on the anniversary of his release. He would call us, and I think he called the Judge Sarakin in California by that time. And so we knew what he was doing, and he got dedicated in two different organizations. One was the Association in Defense of Wrongful Convicted People in Canada. He got a group of Canadian do-gooders and freethinkers to join him in fighting to set aside convictions of people who were wrongfully convicted in Canada and elsewhere. And a number of cases were successful that were brought by that organization. And then he split with that organization and formed a new group called Innocence, something like that. I can't remember the name. And he continued to do that on his own right down to the end of his life. He was interested in supporting a convicted person in Kings County and had just been fighting to help get him out. He did what he thought he should do to return to the world, his principled good efforts to set aside injustices. Rubin was an extraordinary person. He was, when I say he was intellectually very strong, remember that he wrote a couple of books, but it was not just that he wrote the books. He participated with us in the defense of his case, with Leon Friedman of Hofstra, who joined us after the second convictions, and with Lou Steele. He would vet the briefs that we sent. We used to have a relay between Rahway Prison and my office, sending him drafts, and we would get the comments back. He was a very unusual client.
He also took principled stands while in prison, refusing to wear a uniform or to work at prison jobs. Was he well regarded inside?
He was kind of a hero to a lot of the prisoners. Rubin, as you say, refused to act like a prisoner because he wasn't anyone who was guilty, he said. So he didn't eat prison food, he didn't take prison assignments, he didn't wear prison clothes. And somehow or other, he was able to pull that off. Some of the guards even supported him. because they recognize his principled stand. Early on, when one of our appeals failed after, I think it was one of our appeals, I can't remember whether it was one of the earlier appeals, Reuben essentially had an emotional breakdown in prison, a mental breakdown, and he was hallucinating and just like out, you know, beyond the depths of despair. And there was a white, well-known because of his crime, prisoner who took Reuben aside. They were both leaders. One was the leader of the whites and one was the leader of the blacks in the prison, and nurtured Reuben through that time, and he came back even stronger. You can't imagine what a strong person he was. After the second conviction, when our lives were so bleak, I mean, we met in a prison, in a basement prison in New Jersey, and we were weak in spirit, and you know, where are we going to go now? And somehow pulled up our socks and went forward and reestablished our case. But after that second conviction, Reuben did an analysis of all the evidence at the second trial on big, big boards with little flip cards so that you look under what the prosecution claimed and what the evidence, the impeachment evidence was. I still have it. It's like a unique document. It's like 4 by 5 feet wide and has many, many boxes. And that's when I knew he was really coming back. He, as I said, he was a participant in his case as no other client I've ever had.
He truly was extraordinary. He didn't get much of an education. He was in juvenile prisons as a young person. His father was a deacon or a minister in the church, I think.
Yes.
And he had a real moral sense to him. When Malcolm X came around, Reuben recognized Malcolm's moral authority, identified with him. I think that may have been one of the things that got him into trouble, because Life magazine wrote an article.
Yes.
Linking the two.
He was portrayed as a dangerous rebel, and that certainly didn't make him popular in the community in Paterson, New Jersey, at least on some elements of the community. I mean, he had a lot of white friends too. People think of it as being another time. I've been practicing law long enough, so I don't think anything changes. I mean, the same kind of bias runs deep throughout the community. It's just masked somewhat differently, as we see from current events.
Myron, you've had some other significant cases. Can you talk briefly about your representation of one of the so-called Central Park joggers?
Well, we are representing in the office, my partner Karen Dippold and I are representing Yusuf Salam and his family. And my partner John Moore is actually, along with a number of other attorneys, representing three of the other former defendants. So we have 4 out of the 5 of the current plaintiffs being represented in our office. And we've been doing it since 2002, more or less.
It's a damage case, right? I mean, they've already been released.
It's a damage case.
Their convictions overturned. Yeah.
That's right. Well, the convictions were overturned when Mateus Reyes came forward and his DNA matched. But the prosecution, well, the Corporation Counsel, now like substitute for the prosecution, have never given up the claim that somehow the former defendants, now plaintiffs, were involved. And either they came upon the scene after Reyes attacked, or they came on the scene before Reyes attacked, and they attacked the Central Park jogger. So it's like an endless battle. I mean, that's another 12-13 years that we've been at this, trying to get compensation for the young man who spent between 7 and 12 years, depending upon which one was a juvenile and which one was not, in jail for crimes they didn't commit.
But now on that issue, I know you guys are trying to get a settlement with the city, and de Blasio, when he took office, and I don't know what you can speak about, but took office, said he wanted to settle the Central Park jogger damage cases.
Yes, yes, and there are ongoing discussions now, but they've been going on for quite a while, and we're still not there. We're waiting for a good faith offer by the city, and it may never. We hope it will come.
I also recall in the beginning of this interview, you mentioned the George Whitmore case. I knew very little about it. I read this big, thick book that began with George Whitmore and the career girls murders, I guess, in the 50s. Is that right? I think so.
In the 60s.
And they convicted an innocent black men in those cases.
I mean, it's another typical case. I mean, you've got sensational case. Public reaction, of course, is extraordinary. They have to get somebody. They've got this 19-year-old kid who was dyslexic, who was over in Brooklyn one night, and at that same night, there was an attempt to rape a woman, an attempt to sexually assault a woman, and policemen came upon the scene and saw the attacker, and the attacker ran away. The next day, that same cop saw George Whitmore standing on the corner in the same neighborhood. George was there for another reason. He was trying to get a job with his brother. Didn't recognize him, of course, didn't match the description, and in a series of extraordinary events, he ended up being questioned in the precinct by a group of detectives, including those on the case in Manhattan involving what they call the career girls, two young women who had been murdered and raped in the process in Manhattan. And he ended up confessing to the three crimes, the attack on the woman in the alleyway next to a building the night before, the attack on the women in New York, and another third rape murder of a woman in Brooklyn. All of it was completely false. And, you know, in the Miranda decision by the U.S. Supreme Court, it was a footnote of note to refer to the false confessions. I mean, in the career girl cases, there was like 70 pages, roughly 65, 70 pages of information that only the killer would know. And, of course, it was all fed to him. It's all very disgusting because it happens over and over again that bad police investigation works to the, you know, to the great harm of people who are falsely charged. There are many stories in the Whitmore case, one or two worth telling perhaps. It turns out on the day that the two girls in Manhattan were killed, and it turned out later to be found out that George Whitmore was in Wildwood, New Jersey, 6 hours away by car, in the, I guess, the city hall, in the company of the police chief and various other people watching Martin Luther King's I Have a Dream speech. So he could hardly have been in New York. And ultimately, I handled the last of the cases, the one involving the woman who was supposedly attacked and about to be raped in a hallway. And ultimately, we got that set aside when we found a witness in Puerto Rico who was able to give contrary testimony. But in going to Puerto Rico to try to find the witness who was the sister-in-law of the woman who was attacked, Selwyn Rabb and I were at a hotel wondering how we're going to find this person. We learned that she was in Puerto Rico. We learned she was in San Juan area. And I said to Selwyn, in effect, you know, I do what I always do. I'm going to ask the next person who comes by. I would go out in the street and ask people, witnesses. I used to do that kind of thing, you know. And so I turned to the next person who came by, who was the busboy bringing us our fruit for breakfast. And I asked if he knew so-and-so. And it was his wife.
Amazing.
Amazing story. It was his wife. They were separated, but he told us where we could find her. You know, you make your luck in these cases. You just have to, like, forge ahead and keep believing that if your cause is just, you're going to get a result. It's not always true, of course, but we were lucky in the Whitmore case.
I think it's implicit in what you've said, but can you speak briefly about what kind of inspiration you derive from your clients?
Well, you know, we always want to believe that we are working for people, that we are serving people who are innocent. And I know that's not always true for lawyers, but I've had a series of clients who have been not just innocent, but who have been inspirational because of their insistence, despite the fact that they could get out of jail, for example, that they're not guilty and that they ultimately will prevail. I have one right now. I've been waiting for a decision in the Second Department in state court in New York, and I'm waiting for their integrity unit in Kings County to revise the case. This man has been in jail since 1992 and could have gotten out of jail 10 years ago and doing the same kind of stance that Carter had taken. He refuses to admit that he's a sexual offender. He could have been let out and on parole 10 years ago. His insistence on being an innocent person and will not compromise with the system is the kind of inspiration that, you know, pushes us on as lawyers. If the client can do it, then we should, too, put out to the utmost. I guess that's the best answer I can give you.
Thank you so much, Myron Baldock. It's an honor to talk to you.
It really is. I mean, it's extraordinary, your career and what you've done, and, of course, what the system remains, unfortunately.
Well, I'm a long time ever supporter of WBAI, so I appreciate the compliment.
Thank you, Myron Baldock, for being on Law and Disorder.
Take care, everybody.
Have a great day.
Bye-bye.
Bye.
If you want to hear Law and Disorder again, go to lawanddisorder.org on the web. You should also go to Law and Disorder Radio on Facebook.